Can Christianity Convert the Common Man? The fourth talk in a series on Christianity in America was presented by Tim McIntosh on April 17, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, you guys, we're going to start. Here we go. We are off running. So today is April 17. 2 days after tax day, 2013, and this is the fourth installment of American Church History. My name's Tim McIntosh. This is Gutenberg College. I feel obligated to say all these things because I know what it's like. Good. Sam understands why. I always feel lost when I click on a podcast and somebody just starts talking and I want to say, well, who are you and when is this given and, you know, what institution are you representing? So that's why I do that. Last week, we discussed the American Revolution, and I argued that in the United States, there are sort of two revolutions that take place. The first one is a spiritual revolution. The Great Awakening takes place in the early part of the 1700s, and it gives the United States kind of a common identity, okay? Before, you've got cities and towns up and down the eastern seaboard, but the Great Awakening, in a sense, kind of combines the people together, gives them a sense of united identity. And then in 1750, when the acrimony between the United States, excuse me, the colonies and Great Britain begins, there's kind of a forged identity that has taken place, and that galvanizes the people in some ways so that when it comes time to officially break ties with our spiritual and ethnic mother, England, they do so. 1776. So first revolution, spiritual. Second revolution, political. I'm going to read a portion of a letter written by John Adams reflecting back on the American Revolution. I read this last week, but I think it's worth reading again. This is a letter he wrote to a friend in 1818 reflecting back on the American Revolution. Quote, what do we mean by the American Revolution? What do we mean the American War? The Revolution was effected before the war commenced. The Revolution was in the minds and hearts of the people, a change in their religious sentiments of their duties and obligations. The people of America had been educated in a habitual affection for England as their mother country, and while they thought of her as a kind and tender parent, no affection could be more sincere. But when they found her a cruel mother, willing, like Lady Macbeth, to dash their brains out, it is no wonder that their filial obligations ceased and were changed into indignation and horror. This radical change in the principles, opinions, sentiments, and affections of the people was the real American Revolution. John Adams in 1818. We concluded last week asking this question. Is Christianity and rationalism, are they compatible? And I'm going to dwell just a little bit more on that question because it occurred to me in the middle of my talk, I am so familiar with the kind of ideals of the Enlightenment. I'm so comfortable with that. In the middle of the lecture, I felt like I was trying to describe my childhood home in some ways, and I couldn't quite remember what it would maybe look like to someone who had never been in there before. So I'm going to spend a little bit more time talking about what the Enlightenment was, because I think it's really important to understand this, because at this point, after the Revolution takes place, some Christian ideals and some Enlightenment ideals are kind of merged into one, and in some ways, they're kind of difficult to tease apart. Which of these ideals is strictly Christian? Which of these ideals is strictly from the Enlightenment? So I'm going to give a little bit more in-depth description of what the Enlightenment was. And then I'm going to talk a little bit more about this marriage that takes place between the Enlightenment and Protestant Christianity before we actually launch into today's class. Today's class will cover roughly the years 1800 to the beginning of the Civil War, 1861. But a little more background. So, by rationalism, or the Enlightenment, or sometimes modernism, sometimes you might hear the era considered or called modernism. What do we mean? It is a cultural and intellectual movement that begins, usually I see it dated beginning in 1641. That's when a guy named René Descartes publishes a book that is kind of the signal that we are up in a new era. We're in a new era. So background around about René Descartes. René Descartes is trained in theology. He's a Frenchman. He is surrounded by the Protestants and the Catholics warring, who do I trust? Who do I believe? Who has got all the facts on their side? Well, says René Descartes, I have to first figure out whether or not I am sort of like trustworthy as a knowing individual before I can settle that. So René Descartes is the one who comes up with this famous philosophical phrase, you probably know it, I think, therefore I am. And his investigations begin as a single solitary thinking individual, okay? So roughly 100 years after Martin Luther posts his 95 thesis, René Descartes publishes his meditations, and this launches what will become the Enlightenment. Here is a description of the Enlightenment from a guy named Roger Scruton. Gutenberg students read some Roger Scruton. He's a historian of philosophy who's still living. Quote, in the first flush of scientific confidence, the thinkers of the Enlightenment tried to carry over into every human intellectual endeavor the search for first principles, which, in Isaac Newton's physics, had produced such success. The search brought with it a skeptical attitude toward authority, rejecting everything that had no secure foundation. In experience, in history, in morals, metaphysics, in literature, the Enlightenment attitude briefly prevailed, giving rise to the phenomenal ambitions of the French encyclopedist and to their materialistic, almost clockwork, vision of the universe. It produced the political theories which motivated the French and American revolutions and the systematic explorations in chemistry and biology that were to find fruition in the 19th century evolutionism. It also brought about the technical advances which precipitated modern industrialism. Scruton mentioned the French encyclopedist. I'm going to talk briefly about the French encyclopedist because the French encyclopedia that is published right around the time, just before the American Revolution, is like the quintessential Enlightenment document. The subtitle of the French encyclopedia was a 35-volume work, I think, that was hoping to basically gather all human knowledge in these 35 volumes, okay? Not the details, but the general, all human knowledge. It's written and edited between 1751 and 1772 by a Frenchman named Denis Diderot, an Enlightenment champion. His express goal for the encyclopedia is to change the way people think, pure and simple. One of the things that caused great controversy at the time was that on the table of contents and in the organization of the encyclopedia, theology is listed as a subset of philosophy. Now, if you know a little bit of medieval history, this is thoroughly unacceptable. There is no way that this is acceptable. But Diderot, by placing theology below philosophy, is saying that even religion is subject to human inquiry, to rational inquiry, okay? So inquiry in the medieval world might look something like this. God is a perfect being, and we know that he loves his creation because church tradition and the scriptures and, well, Aristotle sort of says it. So they all testify that God's relationship with his creation makes everything kind of happen. This is the picture of the way the universe works in Dante's Divine Comedy. Diderot would say to that, and what evidence do you have for that? Show me some evidence that God's love for his creation is the thing that moves everything. That's not what moves everything. What moves everything is like the natural laws of the universe. Come on, let's get serious here. adding to the controversy surrounding the encyclopedia is this. The entry, Knowledge of God, is listed just above black magic and divination. Okay? So the in the encyclopedia, the entry for Knowledge of God is listed just above black magic and divination. Diderot, in his encyclopedia, is chiefly frustrated, not frustrated, he's angry at the Catholics. He's tolerant of the Protestants, chiefly because they don't like the Catholics either, okay? A little bit more about the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment, of course, is going to reject any notion of the divine right of kings, the divine right of kings to rule. Please, the people rule themselves, okay? The people rule themselves. Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, published the exact same year as the American Revolution, 1776, also puts a dent in this idea that wealth is what is accumulated by a king, the amount of gold in the king's coffers. No, says Adam Smith. Adam Smith says, wealth is created by a nation or a people or an individual when they can combine goods, materials, lands, and labor to generate a good or a service that produces a profit. That's what generates wealth. It's not gold in a king's coffers. No. It's the ability to imaginatively create something that the market, that the people need, and to sell it or to exchange it for another good. The Enlightenment valued freedom, democracy, and reason as the primary values of society. During the years before and after the American Revolutionary War, as I understand it, the Enlightenment ideals and Protestant Christian ideals engage in a marriage. Each member of the couple brings something to the marriage. Christianity brings a deep conviction that each person is valuable to God and known to God. It doesn't matter what family background you have. It does not matter whether you were born wealthy. It does not matter if you have prestige. You are important and valuable to God. He knows the number of hairs on your head. Protestant Christianity also brings, seemingly conversely, a deep suspicion about human beings, that we are a mess, that we are sinful people, and that we are constantly after power and self-satisfaction. Rationalism brings to the marriage a deep conviction that each person is not only valuable, but a rational being who can pursue and achieve their own ends. Once we escape tyranny and superstition and have the courage to think for ourselves, the Enlightenment said, society will be grand. I would say the Enlightenment also brought a strong sense that technological innovation and technological advancement, that is possible. So these things get married together. And I think the way to think of this marriage is that they were married around the time of the American Revolution. The marriage was happy until the early part of the 1800s. The marriage begins to fall apart in the early part of the 1800s. But the marriage stays together because there's a sick child. The nation grows very sick during the Civil War, so they kind of stay together because they're trying to preserve the Union. After the Civil War happens, rationalism and Christianity will separate, and the divorce will become final at the end of the 1800s or the early part of the 1900s. That's the way I think is a kind of a good metaphor to think about it. Okay. Finally, we are on to today's lesson, the two challenges. So just to remind you, I've organized the class around challenges, different challenges that American Christians face as the country kind of develops and changes. The first challenge is, can the common man be converted? So the early part of the 1800s is thought of as the era of the common man. Will the common man be converted? That's the first challenge. The second challenge, is Christianity progressive? Is Christianity progressive? So after the American and French revolutions, the bonds of tyranny and superstition have been thrown off, people think. And the Western world is moving forward. And so Christians face this question, are we also moving forward with the rest of the world? Or are there things that we are not going to embrace as the world rushes forward? Okay? Can the common man be converted? And is Christianity progressive? And then I'm going to close the class with just, with a series of about 10 quotes from a guy named Alexis de Tocqueville. How many of you, Michael, you wrote your thesis on Alexis de Tocqueville. How many of you are familiar with Alexis de Tocqueville? Have ever read anything? Okay. There were a handful of really prominent authors during the middle part of the 1800s who came to the United States or traveled around the United States and who wrote books about the United States because it was just so novel and interesting. For example, Charles Dickens wrote a book about the United States. No one reads it. Everyone reads Alexis de Tocqueville, if you want to know about this time, because he is fascinating. And you'll read him, when I read these quotes, you'll think, oh yeah, that's us. Still, 150 years later, that's us. He just gets it. So his book, Democracy in America, I'm going to close with about 10 quotes, and the quotes are mainly about the relationship of Christianity to America broadly. Common man can the common man be converted? Is Christianity progressive? And then we'll close with Alexis de Tocqueville. So, beginning in Ohio in 1802, state after state began passing laws giving the right to vote to all white men regardless of whether or not they owned property. And by the late 1820s, virtually every state, save Virginia, had abolished the property requirement law. 27 years later, after they begin abolishing the property law requirement for voting, a great hero of the common people is elected president of the United States. Anybody know who that might be? The common man. Who is the common? He was a general during the War of 1812. Andrew Jackson. The common man is elected. His nickname was Old Hickory, and he was the people's candidate. He had no family lineage. He was not like Jefferson. He was not like the Adams family. He was a self-made man, or, well, that's how he kind of sold himself. He maybe had a little bit more prestige than he let on. But for the first time in American history, a man perceived to be of humble origins is now president. Jackson's election showed that a man's lineage was less important than a candidate's ability to succeed and appeal to common voters. During the same time, American Christianity is facing a similar kind of issue. Can we appeal to the common person? Can we appeal to the frontiers of America? Central to this story is a man named Charles Grandison Finney. Okay, I'm going to do another little quiz here. I presume all of you have heard of Abraham Lincoln. I presume all of you have heard about Andrew Jackson and Andrew Carnegie. How many of you have ever heard of Charles Grandison Finney? Okay, see, I think when I read history, Charles Grandison Finney, if you lived in the 1900s, he would have been mentioned in the same breath as Lincoln, Jackson, Carnegie. He's that prominent of a person. He is the next in line of the great revivalists after Jonathan Edwards, after George Whitefield, after John Wesley, comes Finney. Finney was born in 1792. He died in 1875. And he's the central figure in a huge movement in the United States in the early part of the 1800s called the Second Great Awakening. The Second Great Awakening is in many ways like the First Great Awakening that we talked about the second week of class, but it will have some stark differences. And I'll dwell a long time on those stark differences. Those will probably give an indication of the changes in Christianity and also the changes in the United States during the time. Who was Charles Grandison Finney? At age 26, he had entered a law office in Adams, New York. He was practicing law. He was, in his own words, almost as ignorant about religion as a heathen. But he kept noticing in his law books all of these references to the Bible. So one day he goes and he buys a Bible and he begins to read it and he is converted in 1821. He enters a Presbyterian church in 1824 and soon becomes very interested in the revivals, and he begins preaching in revivals. He preached in revivals until 1860, when he was basically just too old to travel. During this late part of his life, he also served as president of Oberlin College, which became an early abolitionist center. What did Charles Finney believe? He is difficult to assess. Unlike somebody like Jonathan Edwards, who's very clear, systematic, logical, thorough, Finney's a little bit all over the map. He's not what you would call very systematic. Even those who really like him kind of have pretty widely differing opinions about what his theology was about. One thing that we can be sure about is that Finney's theology was singularly obsessed with the self. What's happening kind of psychologically in here? So listen, this is a little section from his memoirs. Just listen to how many times he refers to himself, myself, I. Finally, I found myself verging fast to despair. I said to myself, I cannot pray. I then reproached myself for having promised to give my heart to God. My inward soul hung back, and there was no going out of my heart to God. I began to feel deeply that it was too late, that it must be that I was given up of God and was passed over. It's just a little section, but imagine Jonathan Edwards writing about his own conversion, how the position of Edwards would have been very different, I think. I think it would have been much more concerned with what God was doing to him, whereas Finney is much more interested in what is happening inside in response to God. Does that make sense? This difference between Edwards and Finney is going to manifest itself in the way that Finney approaches revivals. Because for Finney, it's going to become all about the psychological motivations, the tricks, the things that you as a revivalist can do to put someone in a psychological position where they are open to God, right? Some of his revivalist methods were quite novel. He wrote how-to manuals on how to stimulate religious excitement. He initiated what he called the anxious bench, a place where anxious souls became the focus of everyone else's prayers and emotions, so he would sit them down at a revival. Everyone would be behind them, and he'd be preaching, and now this person is kind of isolated between the preacher and the rest of the congregation. Not a congregation, it's usually a big tent. Think about the severe social pressure you might feel if you're sitting on the anxious bench. Many during his day were very critical of Finney for his emotion tugging, saying that converts should be in their right mind to receive Christ, not dazzled out of their mind. But more than any other individual of his day, Charles Finney succeeded in joining evangelical religion to social reform, particularly he was against slavery. And he encouraged his converts, and apparently he converted 500,000, to, upon their conversion, engage in social reform, particularly to join the abolitionist movement, or to in some way act against slavery. The legacy of the Great Awakening is very mixed. Some people look at the Second Great Awakening and they say, no, it wasn't a real awakening. It was a bizarre kind of emotional fervor that kind of people got swept up in. And I'm going to give plenty of evidence for a second for that point of view. Other people say, no, it's a legitimate mass movement of God, but it's happening in a place that's very, very different from the English Puritan-dominated Eastern Seaboard. Okay, so even today, people are split on the Second Great Awakening. I'm going to now talk about the Cane Ridge Revival in Kentucky, and all of you are going to say, oh, the Second Great Awakening, if that's what it was about, then it was a fraud. But I urge you to kind of keep open-minded despite things getting very weird. They're going to get very weird here. The Cane Ridge Revival, here's the background. So this is kind of before Charles Finney's time. This is like the cusp of the Second Great Awakening. In 1801, many families had moved from the Eastern Seaboard and had traveled down a trail blazed by Daniel Boone into the rough country of Western Virginia, not West Virginia, but Western Virginia, which later would become Kentucky. These were not soft city folk. These were gruff frontiersmen who had to weather battles with the Shawnee, the Delawares, and the Cherokees. Frontier life was extremely dangerous, very lonely, very difficult. And so when itinerant preachers began to show up on the frontiers, people from miles around would come to these revivals. I'm going to read a section. So what would happen was large groups of people would come. They would set up camp, and there in the Cane Ridge Revival, I think, lasted 5 or 6 days. And I'm going to read a section now from an eyewitness, a guy named Barton Stowe, who kind of describes what happens during some of these revivals. I'll just read it. Just hold on to your hat. Barton Stowe. This is a long section I'm going to read. Okay. The bodily agitations or exercises attending the excitement in the beginning of this century were various and called by various names. The falling exercise was very common among all classes, the saints and sinners of every age and every grade, from the philosopher to the clown. The subject of this exercise would, generally, with a piercing scream, fall like a log to the floor, the earth, or mud, and appear as dead. The jerks cannot be so easily described. Sometimes, no, he's not talking about like people who are jerks. He's talking about like some sort of jerking motion of the body. Cannot be so easily described. Sometimes the subject of the jerks would be affected in some one member of the body and sometimes the whole system. When the head alone was affected, it would be jerked backwards, forwards, side to side, so quickly with the features of the face unable to be distinguished. When the whole system was affected, I have seen the person stand in one place and jerk backwards and forwards in quick succession, their head nearly touching the ground behind and before. All classes, saints and sinners, the strong as well as the weak were thus affected. The dancing exercise. This generally began with the jerks and was peculiar to the professors of religion. By professors of religion, I don't think he means like the university jerks. I think he means those who would consider themselves Christian. The subject, after jerking a while, began to dance, and then the jerks would cease. Such dancing was indeed heavenly to the spectators. There was nothing in it like levity, nor calculated to excite levity in the beholders. The smile of heaven shone upon the countenance of the subject, and assimilated to angels appeared the whole person. Sometimes the motion was quick and sometimes slow. Thus they continued to move forward and backwards in the same track or alley till nature seemed exhausted and they would fall prostrate on the earth or the floor unless caught by those standing up. While thus exercised, I have heard their solemn praises and prayers ascending to God. The barking exercises was nothing but the jerks. A person affected with the jerks, especially in his head, would often make a grunt or bark, if you please, from the suddenness of the jerk. The laughing exercise was frequent, confined solely to the religious. It was a loud and hearty laughter, but one sui generis. It excited laughter in none else. The subject appeared rapturously solemn, and his laughter excited solemnity in saints and sinners. It is truly indescribable. Almost done. The running exercise was nothing more than The persons feeling something of these bodily agitations through fear attempted to run away and thus escape from them, but it commonly happened that they ran not far before they fell or became so greatly agitated that they could proceed no further. Last paragraph. I close this chapter with a singing exercise. This is more accountable than anything I ever saw. This is more unaccountable than anything I ever saw. The subject is in a very happy state of mind, would sing most melodiously, not from the mouth or the nose, but entirely in the breast, the sounds issuing from thence. All such music silenced everything and attracted the attention of all. It was most heavenly. None of us could ever be tired of hearing it. End of quote. Stone concludes by admitting, yes, there were some eccentricities. There was much fanaticism. There was much overexcitement. But he insists that the effects of the Cane Ridge Revival could be seen and were acknowledged in every neighborhood afterwards. So Stone argues that, okay, we know this was bizarre, but the effect that it had on frontiersmen may have been the same sort of effect that a fisherman would have experienced when witnessing one of Jesus' miracles. That's kind of his argument. So, yeah, very weird, but to a frontiersman, this touched them in some way. This moved them in some way. So the second, that Cane Ridge Revival is kind of indicative of the broader flavor, not of everything that happened during the Second Great Awakening. Not everyone started barking like dogs. Not everyone started getting the jerks. But there was much more of that during the Second Great Awakening. Very little of that during the First Great Awakening. The effects of the Second Great Awakening. It placed the individual in a more central role. In a secondary role, theology, doctrine, the scriptures, and the church. Personal emotional response was most important. Theology began to take a backseat, or the fine details of theology began to take more of a backseat. There were two Kentucky revivalists, John Marshall and Jay Thompson, and some local ministers who were kind of theologically savvy, went up to Marshall and Thompson, and they were arguing using the arguments of John Calvin against the Kentucky Revivalists. The Kentucky Revivalists responded, quote, "We are not personally acquainted with the writings of John Calvin, nor are we certain how nearly we agree with his views of divine truth, nor do we care." End of quote. A strange thing about the Second Great Awakening is it is both anti-clerical, but it also spawns a huge number of ministers. So it doesn't like the clerics, but huge numbers of people are joining the ministry and going out in their preaching. Another result of the Great Awakening, Methodism and Baptism become the largest churches or the largest denominations in the nation. Furthermore, there are scads of new denominations that begin during this time. Disciples of Christ, Universalists, Adventists, Unitarians, Transcendentalists, and a number of other spiritually based humanitarian efforts get their start during the Second Great Awakening. More women and young people come into the church and take more prominent roles in the church during this time. Social activism begins to blossom, especially the abolitionist movement and the temperist movements begin during this time. Also, there are strong efforts toward prison reform and care for the handicapped and mentally ill. And there's a huge explosion in volunteer associations. In 1816, the American Bible Association was organized, and within 4 years, they had distributed nearly 100,000 Bibles. It might be hard to appreciate this because I can open up my iPhone and get the complete version of whatever Bible I want to get in a couple of clicks. But for somebody who can neither afford a Bible, does not live anywhere near a bookstore, cannot order through Amazon.com, spreading the Bible all over the place is a significant undertaking and a wonderful thing. So 1816, American Bible Society, 1814, the New England Tract Society, prints 777,000 tracts in a bi-monthly magazine, a Christian almanac, a series of Christian books. In 1826, the American Education Society was formed to aid theological students and to form a female auxiliary of theological students. I think what that means is they enabled women to take theological classes even though they couldn't qualify for getting a full degree. They couldn't go into the pastorate. Many moral reform organizations were begun during this time. And you can understand why the Americans now have all of this freedom. All of this freedom. And they're afraid that if they abuse it, it'll be taken away from them. And one of the chief culprits is drunkenness. On the frontiers especially. You know, you've got a little gin still, or you go to town and you get some liquor, and it just creates all sorts of problems. So the temperance movement becomes central to moral reform during this time. Al Capone is loving this. You know, he's not going to be born for a half a generation or for a couple of generations, but he's excited about this development. Lyman Beecher is one of the central preachers, a revivalist, who is also adamant about moral reform. Lyman Beecher, we'll hear a little bit more about Lyman Beecher's daughter in just a second, so just plant that name, Lyman Beecher, in the back of your head. Organizations like the Massachusetts Society for the Suppression of Intemperance began. Lyman Beecher preached for them, not just for sobriety, but soon began to preach for total abstinence. Soon, states like Maine, Vermont, Rhode Island, Minnesota, Michigan, and Connecticut passed laws completely prohibiting alcohol. Also, the Great Awakening strengthened the abolitionist movement. Baptists and Methodists in the South began preaching not just to slaveholders, but to slaves also. In 1800, a black revival meeting in Virginia, a plan was formed for a slave rebellion, although it was later quashed. Harriet Beecher Stowe, the daughter of Lyman Beecher, writes a book in the middle of the 1800s called Uncle Tom's Cabin. Exactly right. She was the daughter of Lyman Beecher. She studied in Girls' Seminary, which was started during the time of the Second Great Awakening. And she received the sort of education that all happy and successful people do. She studied the classics. That's my little Gutenberg plug. And she and her husband would later start the Underground Railroad for fugitive slaves in Cincinnati, Ohio. Uncle Tom's Cabin, published in 1852, burst into the nation that was growing increasingly divided over the issue of slavery. Did you ever hear what Abraham Lincoln said to Harriet Beecher Stowe when they met? Do you remember what he said?
He blamed her for starting the war.
Yeah, I think he was more teasing her. He said, this is the little lady who started this war, or something like that. I got the impression that it was kind of a friendly jibe. The answer to the first challenge, so is Christianity compatible with the common man, at this time is decidedly yes. Oh, yes. Just as the French Revolution ushered in the era of the common man in France, the election of Andrew Jackson ushered in the era of the common man in the United States, and the Second Great Awakening both capitalized on this trend and also helped start the trend. The second question, is Christianity progressive? During this time in the 1800s, Christians and the nation broadly was very optimistic that the world was advancing rapidly. It was advancing so rapidly that many had the conviction that they were preparing the way for Christ's return. So the Second Great Awakening, their eschatology, to get all theological for a second, their eschatology is post-millennial. They believe that with Christian effort toward cleaning society up, the way can be paved for Christ to return for a golden era, a thousand-year golden era. So a lot of the moral passion that is birthed during the Second Great Awakening is kind of coupled up with this sense that Christ will come back if we can kind of keep things going well, if we can make our society well-ordered, if people are good to their neighbors, Christ will return. The evangelical revivalists of the Second Great Awakening were not the only ones who were feeling optimistic, so I'm going to talk now about, very briefly, about three other kind of little communities that get started that have kingdom hopes, what I will call kingdom hopes. Anne Lee started her own community. She was converted in England by a small group of shaking Quakers, as they were called, and following her conversion, she received a series of visions that Christ's second coming was imminent. Her followers, she preached, were to be on the avant-garde of the new era, the kingdom of God on earth. And it was revealed that the root of all human evil was sexual intercourse. Thus, for her followers, celibacy was essential to prepare for the new era. The original sin of Adam and Eve was a sexual sin, as one hymn of hers later put it, "As lust conceived by the fall has more or less infected all, so we believe that it is only this that keeps our souls from perfect bliss." She arrives in New York in 1776 and establishes the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing, known in shorthand as the Shakers, because they had a very ecstatic worship style. Later in life, Mother Anne, as she was called, performed a series of miracles that convinced her followers that, in fact, she was the second coming of Christ. She was kind of a female member of the Godhead. By 1825, there were 20 Shaker communities. And you probably know the legacy of the Shakers today is what? Do you know the
furniture?
Wonderful furniture. But as a as a religious community, they've all but died away. A second community, the Oneida community, was formed by John Humphrey Noyes, N-O-Y-E-S. John Humphrey Noyes began the Oneida community. Noyes was converted under Charles Finney. He rejected many Christians' belief and established a community in Vermont and later in Oneida, New York. Their production of high-quality steel traps and cutlery is probably their legacy for today. And it ensured their community's economic success. Noyes believed that Christ's second coming had happened in 70 A.D., which meant that millennial perfection was possible because Christ has come already. So biblical communism, the increasingly advantages of life by association, that was what the Oneida community was about. And the perfect community ought to enjoy, you're going to notice a theme here, sex, but not practice marriage. Noyes called this practice complex marriage. I mean, yeah, it's the right name for it. Perfect fellowship comes when every man is married to every woman and every woman to every man. Restricted love, said Noyes, is unsocial and dangerous to a community. A combination of male chastity and a human version of animal husbandry enabled men and women to enjoy sex while confining births to superior individuals. Yeah. Eventually, Oneida was shut down because surrounding communities didn't approve of complex marriage. You're most familiar with this last community. It began when a young man had a series of visions and dreams in upstate New York in the 1820s. His dreams, unlike Anne's and unlike Noyes's dreams, revealed that Christ, yes, had come a second time, but he came after leaving Palestine and appeared in what would eventually be America to the Native American people. In 1830, he published an English translation of what would later become the Book of Mormon and established the Church of Latter-day Saints, a restoration of Christ's early church. So it's just, I mention all these things because there's this kind of progressive, very optimistic, hopeful kind of theme in all of these end times communities. And it just is kind of strange. The Mormons, of course, are they're polygamists. It was just strange. They all have very unique views on sex. They either see it as this great hopeful thing or like, you know, the reason we're in the bad shape that we're in the first place. I don't know why that they all have thing about sex, but anyway, that's what happened. Okay, so we end on this question of is Christianity progressive? And the answer for now is decidedly yes. Even if you don't belong to something like the Oneida community, even if you're just kind of a mainstream Christian who became a Christian during the Second Great Awakening revivals, you're going to agree Christianity and progressive, it's progressive. It's moving forward. Things can get better through our help. Yeah, things can get better. I don't mean progressive like sometimes people call today's liberals progressives. So a very different set of ideals and values, but maybe the same general impulse that through industry and through intellectual endeavors, we can make this world a better place. I'm going to close with a few quotes from Alexis de Tocqueville. I'm going a little bit over time, forgive me. The background of Alexis de Tocqueville. In 1831, he comes to the United States with a friend sent by the French government to study the American prison system. But both of them had ulterior motives. They're like, we're going to actually just check out the U.S. and see what's going on. He publishes his two-volume study. Is it 1838, Michael?
Sounds
roughly correct.
Yeah, I think his visit might have been as early as the 18th.
Maybe so. I've got it as 1831. I'm just going to read a series of quotes, and that'll be the end of class. I'm going to skip this part. Here we go. Here's a quote about de Tocqueville reflecting on Christianity's relationship to the state. Quote, upon arriving in the United States, the religious aspect of the country was the first thing that struck my attention. And the longer I stayed there, the more I perceived the great political consequences resulting from this new state of things. In France, I had almost always seen the spirit of religion and the spirit of freedom marching in opposite directions. But in America, I found that they were intimately united and they reigned in common over the same country. I do not hesitate to affirm that during my stay in America, I did not meet a single individual of the clergy, of the laity, who was not of the exact same opinion on this point. Christianity in America reigns without obstacle by universal consent. The consequence is that every principle of the moral world is fixed. Even though religion in America takes no direct part in the government of society, it must be regarded as the first of the political institutions, for it does not impart a taste for freedom, it facilitates the use of it. I do not know whether all Americans have sincere faith in their religion, for who can search the heart of man. But I am certain that they hold it to be indispensable to the maintenance of republican institutions. This opinion is not peculiar to a class of citizens or to a party, but it belongs to the whole nation and to every rank of society. American clergy keep aloof from parties and from public affairs, and the United States religion exercises but little influence upon the laws and upon the details of public opinion. But it directs the customs of the community, and by regulating domestic life, it regulates the state. I'm going to skip down. Everyone in America adopts great numbers of theories on philosophy, morals, and politics without inquiry, and if we examine it very closely, it will be perceived that religion itself holds sway there, much less as a doctrine of revelation than as a commonly perceived opinion. In democratic nations where all are equal, laws and ideas are always changing, and new truths are constantly discovered, people tend to think that there is an unlimited capability for progress in human perfectibility. I'll close with these two quotes. First one, about public opinion as the chief influence on individuals. Quote, when the inhabitant of a democratic country compares himself individually with all those around him, he feels that he is the equal of any one of them. But when he comes to survey the totality of his fellows and to place himself in constant with so huge a body, he is instantly overwhelmed by the sense of his own insignificance and weakness. the same equality that renders him independent of each of his fellow citizens exposes him to the influence of the public. The public, therefore, among a democratic people, has a singular power that aristocratic nations cannot conceive, for it does not persuade others to its beliefs, but imposes upon them and makes them permeate the thinking of everyone by a sort of enormous pressure upon the individual. And I'll close with this quote. This may be the most famous quote in all of de Tocqueville. If democratic peoples substituted the absolute power of a majority for all the various powers of a despot, the evil itself would only have changed its form. The people would only have succeeded in the difficult task of giving slavery a new face. For myself, if I feel the hand of power heavy on my brow, I am little concerned to know who it is that oppresses me. I am no better inclined to pass my head under the yoke because a million men hold it for me. That's just a really powerful quote. That was Alexis de Tocqueville, I believe, in 1838. We will take up the story next Tuesday with the beginning of the Civil War. Any questions or comments? Yes. We covered a lot of ground, you guys. Thanks for hanging on.
Was there a lot of controversy, given that most people were taking some amount of progressivism as an overarching meta-narrative? Was there a lot of controversy of what progress would then mean? Because one person's progress would be another person's regress if they have differing value systems.
So give me an example of differing value systems seeing progress, one of them seeing progress and another value system seeing regress.
Well, in modern times, for instance, take the homosexual debate.
Mm-hmm.
To one person, that would be progress for that change to happen. To another person, that would be regress.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you could go that way on any political or religious issue.
Yeah. I think that you are kind of imagining that the pluralism of values and religion that we have today in the United States was prevalent back then. Certainly, there were people who dissented with mainstream Protestant Christianity at this time. I could give you like dozens of different offshoots, the Transcendentalists in New England, the Oneida community, things like this. But I think broadly, as a populace, there's not going to be a huge amount of dissent about what is considered progress. You may want to have a beer on the weekend, and thus you may oppose what the abolitionists stand for, the abolishment of all alcohol. But you probably would recognize that drunkenness is just not a good thing. It's not just something that, you'd probably just be in agreement with the abolitionists that drunkenness is not a good thing, even if you went out and did it every weekend, I expect. Does that make sense?
The strength of the period is the solidarity of the worldviews. Like, there's not a lot of plurality. Because there's not a lot of plurality, there's so much agreement that it's easy to move towards whatever goal.
Yeah, I think so. Because that's what I read in those de Tocqueville quotes, is that Christianity is common opinion at this time in the 1800s. It's just common opinion. It rules. It's everywhere. Again, I don't mean to say that there's not some level of pluralism, but nothing like we've got today.
Okay.
Nothing at all.
Okay, and that would be a strong contrast to today, right?
Yeah, very strong.
Very strong contrast. Interesting.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.